Boy, I don't know how many of you are able to watch that video rolling in before we go live, but it really is worth your effort. When you look at some of the interviews we've done over
people
time,
on the podcast can't
yeah,
see it.
Yeah, I know, I understand.
We should play it,
yeah,
Caleb.
Yeah, it is a James O'Keefe moment that we were showing you there. We did, James Fryman did his own James O'Keefe activism there by having a meeting with the FDA, which unbelievable things were revealed that in retrospect, worse. I remember being astonished at the time, and now I'm deeply concerned. In any event, we have James O'Keefe today. He recently, in disguise, was talking to a White House cyber official who said, quote, they can't say it publicly. The White House wants to replace Kamala Harris and confirms that Biden's got some issues. And, quote, I'm just telling you what I've heard. They're really concerned about it. I think they need to get rid of him or her. That is right out of the horse's mouth, and that's James O'Keefe. I think you all know him from Project Veritas. We will get to him after this.
Our laws as it pertains to substances are draconian and bizarre.
The psychopaths start this way.
He was an alcoholic.
Because of social media and pornography, PTSD,
love addiction,
fentanyl and heroin,
ridiculous.
I'm a doctor, for Christ's sake. Where the hell do you think I learned that?
I'm just saying.
You go to treatment before you kill people.
I am a clinician. I observe things about these chemicals.
Let's just deal with what's real.
We used to get these calls on Loveline all the time.
Educate adolescents and to prevent and to treat.
If you have trouble you can't stop and you want help stop it, I can help.
I got a lot to say. I got a lot more to say.
Valentine's Day is around the corner, so it is time to look your absolute best. Our friends at Genucel are celebrating Valentine's Day with a special gift just for you. From now until Valentine's Day, get a limited time gift of beauty box free with your order at Genucel.com/Drew. Each beauty box has two of Genucel's top sellers for you to give a try. It's absolutely free. And right now, save over 60% off all of our favorite Genucel products with one of our customized skincare packages.
I know I'm a snob about the products I use on my face. Everybody knows it. Every time I go to the dermatologist's office, they're just rows and rows of different creams. Retinols, vitamin C cream, under eye cream, night creams.
Scrubs.
And then when I get to the counter, they're overpriced. All kinds of products that you can all find at Genucel.com.
Plus, with its immediate effects, Genucel promises results that will make you smile. It's guaranteed or 100% of your money back. To let yourself and a loved one with our limited edition bundles right now at Genucel.com/Drew. Use our special code Drew at checkout for extra savings off your order today. And remember, every order placed is automatically upgraded to free shipping. Don't wait. That is Genucel.com/Drew, GENUCEL.com/DREW.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
We are very privileged today to have James O'Keefe. He is an in-person activist, so to speak. You know him, as I said, from Project Veritas. You can follow him on X at James O'Keefe, K-E-E-F-E. Also, OKeefeMediaGroup.com is the website. And it's a real privilege to have him here. Welcome, James O'Keefe. Welcome, sir.
Hello there. Great to be with you.
Hey, good to be with you as well. And I think we briefly passed in the night in South Dakota at the Freedom Fest. Dave Smith kind of introduced us for a second, and then I think you were up on the stage. This was like, I think, 2 years ago. But good to see you again, nonetheless.
Great to see you again.
So, most recently, let me, if you don't mind, I'm sure you've been asked these questions a million times, but it's just for the purposes of my audience. Let's just go through your evolution. How did this happen to you that you ended up in this kind of journalism, and what motivated it?
Well, that's a long story, but let me try to say it in a New York minute. I was in college. I'm 39. So when I was 19, I basically started a little Rutgers. New Jersey, State University of New Jersey. I started a magazine called The Centurion. It was a monthly investigative, muckraking kind of organization. And you know, most journalists, most people are commentators. They opine about the news of the day. And I decided to really dig into my campus issues. So I investigated how much my professors are making. I did a lot of like agitprop kind of gonzo journalism, like in the style of, I guess you could say, Borat meets 60 Minutes. And it, one thing led to another. I did Planned Parenthood things. I did this story on Acorn with a guy named Andrew Breitbart. That was in 2009. That led to the congressional defunding of Acorn when Barack Obama mm-hmm. was president. And then I started a nonprofit called Project Veritas, ran that for 14 years. We did some massive stories on elections, stories on pharmaceutical companies, stories on media bias. Was fired from the company I founded a year ago, a week after I did a story on Pfizer. And now I'm doing OMG, which is focused mostly on the border right now. But I am noticing that society is changing in the last few months and whistleblowers are coming out of the woodwork everywhere.
Are you going after them? Is that what's happening? You're able to get to them?
There was one story in particular that occurred 2 months ago with IBM. A guy came to me with an IBM high level person and had a recording of the CEO of IBM, a man named Arvind Krishna. This was like December 10th or so. And usually when whistleblowers come to me or deep throat type sources, it's one or two people. But what I've been noticing with the Border Patrol and everywhere else is that when this IBM person came to me and I published the recording of the CEO, the recording showed the CEO of IBM saying that, oh, we can't hire Asian people. You know, the more you fire white people, the bigger your bonus is going to be. These are some pretty shocking quotes. And when I published that, 150 people inside IBM contacted me. I've never seen anything like that. In fact, what's remarkable is that, and this was definitely, as you call it, an O'Keefe moment, we published the tape of the IBM CEO, and then the IBM CEO's emergency all-staff meeting with his 60,000 employees. And the thing that he says is, don't talk about James O'Keefe. And that meeting was sent to me by 7 IBM employees. So what I'm starting to witness in what I do is that there's just been this explosion of people following their conscience. And they have absolutely nowhere to go. They certainly can't go to the New York Times or CNN or I don't know, wherever people used to go. So they go to me.
And so let's sort of standing back, you know, and I'm going to ask you to opine for a second, if you don't mind. And I know the muckraking is a little bit of a different posture, which is what is happening? And this is a question that's a thought bubble over my head all the time. What is happening to us as Americans, and what is happening to journalism and cable television, all these crazy, crazy distorted outlets?
That's an existential question. I wrote a whole book trying to answer that question called American Muckraker is the name of the book. It's a combination of things. I think certainly economics, you know, of media. Why does it always the citizens? Why is it always the independent people? I don't even have a lot of money. Why isn't it the big behemoth corporations that do the work? We did a story on Jeff Epstein and ABC News, Amy Robach, that's the then anchor for Good Morning America, is on a hot mic, on her lav mic during the commercial break, talking freely about how she couldn't report on Jeff Epstein because the leader of ABC News was close to the British royal family. So you have this sort of dynamic in mass media where the media operates in symbiosis.
Whoop, there we are. Sorry,
government. That was your. It doesn't investigate government. Yeah. You have this sort of symbiotic relationship, and there's a great book about that called Manufacturing Consent by Noam Chomsky. There's a symbiotic relationship between when you should be investigating and being adversarial and being skeptical. You have to kind of ally yourself with federal agencies, and then you got the pharmaceutical issue, you know, and brought to you by Pfizer and all this sort of thing, where they fund most of media. So you have to be in symbiosis with those entities.
What Ryan, really, if again, it's sort of just another way of describing exactly what you've described. You're talking about ossified elites elites. And what's kind of fascinating about this, our version of elite, these were the people, and I've sort of watched this coming on. I saw it in college campuses too, which is these elites were the muckrakers / talking shit to authority. They were the ones, you know, the good guys that were getting rid of the guys in the white shirts and the skinny ties. And they really are so stock in the notion that all goodness is centered in them, that they can't see where they have become, where they've fallen short, where they've become part of the problem. And I noticed it in college campuses when I said this probably 10 years ago, and I think it was the Evergreen thing that got me going, with where Brett Weinstein and his wife were nearly killed, which was, well, these administrators cannot speak like adults to young people because that's what they hated when they were in college. They hated, remember, you're too young for this, but it was question authority. Don't trust anybody over the age of 35. This was their reason for living. And now they've become the authority, and they wouldn't dare tell a young person what to do and what to think. And they're behaving, the elites, the administrations, are behaving like children themselves. And so there's no adults in the room. And guess what happens when that goes on? Things go sideways. So that was my first sort of sense of it. It was going on college campuses. And now it's gone further, right? Where the ossification is, as you're saying, in the media elites, with the government, with the corporations. And in a certain way, I want you to comment on what I've laid out, but is it not the case that it really, what it starts to veer into is a fascism? It's a kind of a fascistic thing, which is government corporate unification. That's it.
Well, it's literally that, because the FBI raided my home and pointed guns at me and took my reporter notebooks, which is a Rubicon that has been crossed as a journalist. Rarely does journalists get raided by the FBI. In fact, I'm not aware of a case where a media organization was raided by the FBI, where they're confiscating notebooks. And then they would say, well, James O'Keefe is not a journalist. Well, that's a very interesting question, because if the news organizations aren't doing journal, who is a journalist? So that's another story. But my comment on what you said is that what I've found to be true of media organizations, they're not willing to break news. Most media organizations will opine or comment or react to news that someone else has broken, but the liability associated with sort of breaking new ground, especially television news, you know, they'll cover everyone. Sort of, you have like 0.1% is actually showing new information, and then you have 99.9% of media, you know, commenting on it. And I think that's because it's risky. No one wants to break new ground. And what I do is we break new ground. We have people on tape reporting sensationally blockbuster things, people lying, cheating, stealing, scamming, and then people sue you for defamation. The government harasses you. It's expensive. You know, Mike Wallace back in the day, and now dead, but 60 Minutes used to do this 45 years ago. You had Chicago Sun-Times, and they did all types of undercover things. Not all of it video-based. And of course, Upton Sinclair 100 years ago in the jungle, you know, light undercover work, but wrote a novel. A lot of it was sensationalized, and it's frowned upon. And I think the biggest thing I've learned is, you know, the New York Times attacking me constantly. It's like, why are you attacking me? We should be on the same team. But they got those sources inside the Department of Justice, and it's almost like there's a manipulation that occurs between, I don't call them journalists, but the people, the New York Times and the government. The government's kind of manipulating those journalists, force feeding them the information. They parrot it without skepticism, and journalists are supposed to be skeptical.
Well, it feels like the model has changed on two levels. One is the business model has changed. I had a show on HLN for years, and we couldn't put reporters out on the field. That was like laughable. We were doing a talk show, essentially, a talk show about the news. That's what cable TV has become. They've closed down all their, and it really started, frankly, not just with the business model shrinking, but also with celebrity news. That was cheap. That was easy. They could close down all their bureaus and just report on Britney Spears. And they'd get better ratings. And so off they went. You know, they are, and it's funny. And I'm not a journalist. I've said it over and over and over. I'm not a journalist. I was hosting a show. We talked about things. And I think most of cable news has become like that. It's funny. I bring this story up again. I'm just bringing it up for you really quickly. I saw a Soviet journalist in the 1970s. This stayed with me to this day. I was watching like it was a news magazine like you're describing. And this sort of Mike Wallace guy was beating up this Soviet journalist. You know, how can you merely... you're under such influence from the government. You're just pirating what the government is saying. How can you call yourself a journalist? And the Soviet guy finally pushed back hard and said, "Hey, look," he goes, "our models are different. Journalism in our country is a political instrument. In yours, it's a commercial instrument. But trust me, your distortions will be just as bad as ours." And here we are. Took about 50 years, but isn't that interesting?
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot to say about that. I mean, the First Amendment, it's all about informed consent, and the public has a right to know in the United States. So our principle is the public's right to know the information. Does the public have a right to know it? That's a very unique and novel and perhaps revolutionary idea. You're absolutely right. In the Soviet Union or Russia, it's more Potemkin village. The journalists are escorted through and shown a fake thing that is in alliance with the state, but I would say to you that it's gotten so bad. I'm not sure that the commercial imperative is compatible with the news, and I say that as someone who's probably more of a capitalist and I suppose libertarian approach to economics. But I think the laissez-faire dynamic with journalism, I don't think it works. I think you have to be extremely philanthropic as a newsman. If like I'm the chairman. I was the chairman of Project Veritas. Sometimes our legal bills were millions and millions of dollars a year. So you have to be a loss leader. You have to spend a tremendous amount of money, perhaps not profiting on most of your news. News is a very philanthropic endeavor. We can spend upwards of $1 million to do one story, and there's no way you're going to recoup your costs on that. So I don't think anyone has really figured out a business model for journalism that is not a 501c3 model. Right now at OMG, I have a combination of models. We also have a 501c3 called Citizen Journalism Foundation. We have some sponsors. We have some like Tucker's doing behind the paywall stuff, but I don't think anyone's figured that out. I mean, ABC News is a $1 billion company or whatever it is, Disney, and they've completely axed their investigative journalism bureau. So this is a really fascinating conversation. And I write about a lot in American Muckraker.
You know, you are sort of making my point for me. There is not a business model for journalism, and so right. They are going the direction they go. Caleb, do we have the video from the White House staffer I referenced in the opening comments? Is that what I'm hearing? I'm not sure if I understand the text I'm getting from our producer. Oh, I don't know if Caleb can talk to me. He can't talk to me. Okay.
He can't talk because his roadcaster crashed. Okay. So,
do we have that video?
I don't know.
Okay.
I can look. Maybe he can text me.
Let's after the break. But you will ask. I have some other questions for James in the meantime before we get.
Yeah,
to
and
that.
Also we're not on Spaces, so
I saw that.
Just don't worry about that.
Yeah, I saw that.
All right, we're having a little
audio stuff here and there today.
Alabama roadcaster.
Yeah,
but the sound still works.
You're being told by the, shall we call it, mainstream media, legacy media. What's our name? What are we going to call the New York Times at all? You have a name for that?
I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, some people call them corporate media, legacy media.
Right,
maybe.
Corporate media. I like corporate media. So corporate media calls you, says you're not a journalist. Is Tucker a journalist?
Well, they also called him not a journalist. I like the phrase not a journalist, not hyphen a hyphen journalist. They said Tucker wasn't a journalist after his Vladimir Putin interview. The United States Attorney's Office in New York literally wrote a memo to the federal judge in my FBI case saying, and you can't make this up. This is what the prosecutors actually said this. Your Honor, James O'Keefe is not a journalist because he secretly records people. There's a lot of journalists that have done that for the last 50 years. But I think that fell out of fashion. I suppose, in the 90s with Diane Sawyer being sued for a food line investigation. It was all about lawsuits and litigation. And a lot of this was economics. I don't think it was politics. I really think it's just journalists are lazy. And like you said, they sit in booths and talk. They take a black limousine to this office. They go up to the air-conditioned studio. They make $1 million a year. And they don't really do a lot of field reporting. They don't really do a lot of original stuff. So I think it's more just the dynamics of power and money than anything else.
Yeah, they're talk show hosts. That's really what they're doing. They're hosting a talk show. And I don't have any problem with that, but let's be honest about what it is. It's you're hosting a good morning show, or you're hosting a talk show where you talk about the news. Fine. And guess what? You should have an opinion if you're a host of a show, or you should sort of go ahead.
The police have been called on me almost every single time. Every single time they call the police on me, and I say that for a reason, not because I'm doing anything illegal, but look at the difference between like what we're doing, where every single time I'm out and about, like with my microphone. So what do you have to say about this? You were caught on tape here by this guy, or there's a secret Ramada Inn filled with illegal immigrants, and some of them are lying about their sponsorships, and my illegal immigrant source has recorded this guy, and they call the sheriff's office on me. So you know you're doing something right when every single time now. How many times have these people in their talk shows and their broadcast booths had the police called on them? When's the last time they were raided by the FBI? And I hate to say that because they don't break the law, but there was a great journalist called Gary Webb in the 90s. There's a movie made about him called To Kill a Messenger. You may have heard of it. And Gary Webb wrote a book. I believe that book was also called To Kill a Messenger. And he said, for a long time, I was winning Emmys and I was winning Pulitzer Prizes. And I was, you know, speaking at journalism schools, and I felt so good about myself. And then I broke a story. He did this story about the CIA and drugs in Los Angeles that made me realize how sadly misplaced my bliss had been. The reason I had encountered all that smooth sailing for so many years is because I never broke a story important enough for them to try to censor. And this is a guy who was being accoladed and, you know, And as the hardest part of my journey, I've been doing this for 20 years, 15 years in major ways. I've been lied about and defamed so many times. And for a large part of that decade of constant defamation, you begin to realize that human beings don't like to be hated. They don't like to be their Wikipedia page to be filled with filth. So that when you're you're read about and you're just, you think I'm a monster. Nobody likes to live that way. And I think we've reached a tipping point, or I suppose now in the year 24, where I think most people, most Americans are starting to read between the lines, and they realize, well, maybe Wikipedia isn't so honest, and maybe being praised by CNN isn't the most important virtue. I think if we haven't gotten to that tipping point, we're pretty much about to be.
That's good to hear, because it's something has to break the elite stranglehold. It just seems to me. So let me ask this: let's adopt their notion as a fact or principle. Let's say you're not -a- journalist. Let's say you're not a journalist. Let's adopt that. What are you if you're not that?
I have in my pocket a funny joke. I say, I'm a, it's like Bruce Willis's quote from the Fifth Element. I'm negative. I'm a meat popsicle. I'm a Captain Kangaroo. It's nomenclature. I'm not a journalist. Yeah. But they're obsessed with that, the identity politics of, and I think that there was a sponsorship on the congressional floor years ago where Chuck Schumer was trying to define a journalist. It was a very difficult thing to do because journalism is an activity. It's not merely an identity. You are, as Aristotle say, you are defined by what it is that you do. So it's a very fascinating question. They try to create a shield law for journalists, but I think that, you know, when it came to the founders and pamphleteers and the kind of work that you're doing, it's important to understand that it's the activity, not the identity.
And it's almost... No, I don't know if I'm going to say this, but I'll say it. We'll chew on it a little bit. I got to take a break in a second, but it's almost the discourse it generates that's important, right? I mean, it's it's, you talk about the pamphleteers during the founding fathers era, that was about creating conversation and distributing information. And it came around again in the mid-19th century where, gosh, if you read the Lincoln-Douglas debates from Douglas's journalist versus Lincoln journalist, you would read two entirely different debates entirely. Like Lincoln has gone on the record. He actually went and read, he would read both versions and then collate it and put it all down the way he remembered it or where he'd written it out partly. And presented that to the newspaper and said, these are the debates. And we've forgotten that journalism, it's not a profession historically. I mean, does it have professional licensing? I guess it begs the issue, should it? I hope not, because that goes at speech then. What do you think?
I mean, these are profound issues you bring up that are very difficult to reconcile, but I think the independence, I mean, you know, Elon Musk buying X, in my opinion, and echoing what Charlie Kirk said, is probably one of the greatest developments in the Western civilization, because you have now what appears to be a very free platform. Our videos, that White House video you mentioned a minute ago, the one that I got 2 weeks ago of the cybersecurity, that was viewed 30 million times. 30 million people watched that. And video journalism is extremely important. You know, like the primetime live undercover stuff from 30 years ago, people need to see. It makes all the difference when people can see something, you know, it's versus a newspaper article or a pamphleteer or whatever they did before video. It changes the whole dynamic of how we perceive the world around us when we can kind of see that White House official. When he's talking, you hopefully your producer can pull it up in a moment, but he goes, "Oh, you know, I work in the White House, and they all think Kamala Harris is horrible, and she treats black staffers horribly, and she's a bad leader." And I say, "Well, can't you say that publicly?" "Oh, no, we can't say that publicly. Oh no, because she's a black woman." But what's remarkable is that as long as there's a gap between how these Washington D.C. people talk, like amongst each other in bars, and the official Potemkin propaganda that they feed to the New York Times, as long as this not the same, there will always be ripe opportunity for people like me to expose them. And let's face it, there is an artifice that is pervasive throughout, I guess, that's just part of life. I mean, people are phony, and there's phony baloney in media, there's phony baloney in business, and you know, but when it comes to our elected officials, you know, people have a right to know. People thought, "Oh, James, you're unfair for secretly recording people. You're going to ruin their lives." Well, in this country, in the United States, it's founded on the public's right to know. And journalism does hurt people. Some really good journalism sometimes hurts people. But the public's right to know trumps all that shit. The public's right to know the information is the most important thing. And not lying to the audience, that's why we go undercover. That's why we use pretense. That's why we're guerrilla, because we have to get the truth to the people. And if I just parrot what they tell me, "Hi, I'm a journalist. Tell me how honest you are." If I just parrot that, then I'm lying to the audience. And that's what corporate media does. That's what legacy media does. That's what people who are brought to you by Pfizer, that's what they must do, because they can't be skeptical of all of the organs of power. So you kind of have to be independent. You have to be without a safety net. You have to be a kind of tight band of brothers, which is what I've found. And take it from a man who's fired from the company he founded. My board fired me, and I had to start another company. So it's very guerrilla, you know, in how you do it.
All right, we got a lot to talk about. You just prompted a ton of stuff in my head. So we're going to take a little break. We are going to get that video so another 10 million people can see it. I want to talk a little bit about the right to know versus ethical discomfort we might have with the right, you know, how the right to know gets elucidated. I'll tell people what a Potemkin village is. If you don't know, it's been referenced a couple of times, and you might want to check out Michael Malice's White Pill, which is all about Potemkin villages. And I want to talk a little bit about your firing. So there's a lot to get into, James. I appreciate you being here. We'll take a quick break and be right back.
Thank you.
Are you one of the millions of American women and men dealing with premature hair thinning and hair loss? Or maybe you're scared about inheriting that thinning look because it runs in your family? Start 2024 with a real solution that delivers results without the harsh side effects or unwanted chemicals and no need for a prescription. Previa uses a safe natural ingredient, Procapil, to effectively target the three main causes of premature hair thinning and hair loss. By supporting healthy scalp circulation, the delivery of nourishing nutrients, and healthy hair follicle anchoring to your scalp, Provia guarantees more hair on your head than in the shower or on your comb. Right now, new customers save over 50% plus free shipping. Every introductory package includes a full 60-day supply of Provia serum for daily use, plus the Provia Super Concentrate for faster, more noticeable results. Don't wait. Order now to save an extra 10% and get free shipping at proviahair.com/Drew. That's P-R-O-V-I-A-H-A-I-R, proviahair.com/D-R-E-W. As a physician, I am deeply concerned about efforts to erode the doctor-patient relationship. And as medical freedom continues to come under assault, I'm on a mission to empower you to be able to take care of yourselves and your family the way you want to. I urge you to get this medical emergency kit from The Wellness Company. It contains essential prescription medication you should really always have on hand. Here's Dr. Peter McCullough, Chief Scientific Officer.
It's a very broad and diverse medical kit. Can handle everything from urinary tract infection, a fungal infection, a bronchitis. People can, you know, via telemedicine, get their questions answered and get on the right track. But it's basically an at-home formulary. Yep. For the first time, people, instead of being held captive by an urgent care or by a doctor's office or an ER, they can actually do this themselves at home.
Save yourself the wait and the hassle and feel better faster. Go to drdrew.com/TWC for 10% off. That is drdrew.com/TWC for 10% off the medical emergency kit.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
We're back with James O'Keefe. It's at James O'Keefe, K-E-E-F-E. Uh-oh, is there something after that? And also at O'Keefe Media. Thank you, James, for being here again. As I said, a quick question for you technically. We have the full 13-minute video of your undercover conversation with the White House staffer. Is there a particular minute or so that's of relevance?
Do you know sort of the first 2 minutes, or maybe, you know, we do it with these videos. We usually try to take the whole story and then compress it down into a 2-minute version. So if we just play like the first 90 seconds, maybe.
All right, let's do that.
So you're pretty high up in the government.
Yeah, I'm fairly high up. I'm good at keeping secrets. And so I manage two federal agencies, the State Department and USAID.
So when you say it's like security, like you're protecting
the networks of the federal agencies that you give all your information to.
The mission is to protect information.
And we are like the president's voice when we go into meetings in terms of discussing and promoting the president's priorities.
Is he going to be the nominee?
Yes. And she will be the vice president nominee.
Yeah, I don't.
There was a debate about removing her from the ticket, but sadly they didn't.
She can't keep black staff. They quit on her en masse.
But with him, I know. He's got dementia.
He's definitely slowing down.
But they know that he has those issues.
I think so.
But they're not willing to say it.
Shows it.
And they're not willing to say it publicly.
And same thing with Kamala Harris. She's not popular, but you can't remove the first black lady to be vice president from the goddamn presidential ticket. Like, what kind of message are you going to send to, like, the African-American voter? How would you spin that? People would be like, what the fuck? Like, she's a woman and she's multiracial. I think that they're really concerned about this.
But they won't say it. Well, I guess if they say it publicly,
correct.
Biden
can't say it
publicly. Is they can't say it publicly.
No, they've got to
they
toe the line.
Do they say it privately? But they won't say it publicly.
Correct.
Biden
can't say it
publicly. Is, no. They can't say it publicly.
No, they've got it. They've got
to they say
the
it
line.
Privately?
All right, let's kind of wrap. We get the vibe. Yep. We get the.
You're just telling me the truth.
Does it make sense? No.
Time to stop, Caleb. There we go. So we get it. And what
I remember that.
What happened to this poor guy? Do you know?
No, the system has become wise to me. Usually they get fired them, but even if they do fire them, they probably do it so quietly because it would trigger an Associated Press bulletin if they fire this guy. This guy's not a low-level guy. He's cybersecurity, went to Harvard, overseas, USAID and the State Department. And I want to make one comment about what you just saw. That statement, we can't say it publicly. Like that you have someone who works for the state, who's on the inside, he's there in the executive office, the White Eisenhower building. They don't talk like that when they go on the media, do they? No. They don't talk that normally, that conversational, the cadence, the honesty. You might be thinking, oh, I'm getting him drunk. No, I think he drank like maybe half a glass of wine. It wasn't that. It was that there's just so much fakeness in our politics. And imagine how more educated people would be if they saw those types of conversations done at scale.
So let's again adopt your point of view. Is he wrong?
No, he's honest.
He's right. He's right. You can't say stuff like that. Yeah. So he couldn't.
Wrong
the reality
in
is,
what are you saying?
But behind that, people get into a very, and I don't think that's the purpose of this conversation, but people get into a very deeper waters with it's justified because we're righting wrongs, we're bringing things into the present, and that's just the way it is, just how we do it.
Which they get upset at the methods by which it was obtained, or do you mean something different?
No, I want to get that too. No, they would say, of course, we can't talk about it. It's not savory, but we have to protect her and that point of view to make sure that people like her are given the appropriate support and jobs and move forward. That they feel justified in that.
I think that. The money shot of all the things in that video, and usually this is typically the money shot, it's when the subject says, we can't say it publicly. The Pfizer guy a year ago said the same thing. He said, promise me you won't tell anybody anything when I'm about to tell you. Whenever they say that, that's when we fix our camera. Hey, would you just say that right into the button, sir? That's when we get really, our ears get finely tuned to what's about to be said. It's the deception. It's the law of non-contradiction. The person can't say X and then say opposite of X. You cannot say as a public official who works in the White House, it's perhaps the greatest issue in the history of the United States, this election between Biden and Trump, And who's the vice president is very important, by the way, for reasons I don't even want to state. You cannot say, well, we don't want to tell people that. We don't want to explain these issues. I mean, you have an obligation to tell people that. In fact, it's the nadir, it's the worst type of evil to say to people, well, we can't say this to the American people. It doesn't get much worse than that. But that's the status quo, isn't it? And we all participate in the parade. And most Americans, frankly, to be honest with you, they just believe what they see on local news and believe what they see on national news. They question nothing. They're too busy working. Most people just don't want to disbelieve the narrative because it's easier to live that way, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah, it is. And it is, I must tell you, it's uncomfortable to see what you do. It doesn't... And I'm framing this specifically for a reason. It doesn't feel right. It feels like some ethical cords are pulled upon, that it doesn't feel like somebody should be subjected to this. Go ahead and answer that.
I wrote a whole book. There's a chapter in American Muckraker called Ethics. And I really, I'm probably one of the, I've read more on journalism ethics than probably most journalism school professors. And there's a chapter in there, and I don't have a photographic memory, but I'm going to do my best to recite what I know. I mean, Ernest Hemingway, who once wrote about ethics, said, what is good is what you feel good after. This is like a very minimalist way of saying this. What is good is what you feel good after, and what is bad is what you feel bad after. So perhaps when it comes to journalism, it's not so much what is good is what you feel good after. It's you're better off having done it than if you didn't do it at all. And I find that with most of our work, you're better off knowing this information. When it comes to deception, it's a question of relative deception, because either you're deceiving your audience by parroting all this propaganda, this Potemkin, which is what they accused Tucker of. And some of those criticisms would have merit if Tucker wasn't challenging Putin. And I haven't watched the full interview yet, admittedly. There it is. So it's a question of relative deception. So if you are parroting the propaganda talking points, then you are committing a sin. You are committing a pretty bad one. You're lying to your audience. So if the person says, "Well, this is X," when really it's Y, then you're telling your audience something that's false. Or you must deceive your subject in order to tell the truth to your audience. And in many circumstances, it becomes a moral imperative for you to deceive the person that you're talking to so that you can get the truth out of that person and distribute that to millions of people. I think as an ethicist, which I'm not, but I'm a journalist, so I have to deal with this. I think it's a pretty easy formula. You have to deceive the individual, pose as something you're not, don't tell them who you are, so that you can get that truth. Upton Sinclair certainly did that when he smuggled his pencil into the jungle in Chicago. No one thought that was bad. Everyone think you'd read about that in high school. But what makes this different is technology. It's the camera. People don't want their dignity be photographed. They don't want their photo distributed, their likeness. And I get it, but the photograph, the camera, is a more honest version of events than the written down version, which unfortunately dominates the newsrooms of the New York Times and the Washington Post.
And I don't disagree with anything you say, but this becomes really interesting territory because, A, as Hemingway points out, moral sensibilities is probably the foundation of morality. I mean, there are moral philosophers and theorists out there. And really, as I read that philosophy, when you get right down to it, there is a moral sensibility, whether it's the famous streetcar experiment or whatever it is. People have feelings about these things. But the job, though, is not to stop at the feeling and to really use the front part of your brain to develop an ethic that either defends or refutes that feeling. And what's interesting about what you've just presented to me is you said it should be a moral imperative. So now we're going to Kant, right? And so I don't disagree with you that it's a moral imperative, but Kant has a second injunction, which is no one should be used as a means to an end. And I think that's the part. I get it. But I think that's the discomfort in all this. People can't quite navigate that.
There's a mathematician once described it's sort of like portfolio management, which is above my head. But it's like if you were to graph this out, there's an efficiency frontier. I was talking to the Weinstein brothers about this. And they're mathematical geniuses. There certainly is a point where it's like, okay, that's wrong. And where that line is, you know, there's another woman, Jessica Mitford, who wrote a book, The Gentle Art of Muckraking. Where that point is where you go, this is a little disgusting, right? That's unclear.
Feeling again. Yeah.
Well, it's clearly situational. I wouldn't necessarily describe it as a feeling. I think it's more rational because privacy is a great example of this. I never report on anything happening in someone's bedroom, consensual sex, unless they're using taxpayer dollars, unless they're a senator, you know, using the public coffers. Obviously, there are places I won't go. And I think that's completely situational. There's no hard and fast rule when it comes to ethics. It has to be situational. And I think that it's clearly the case if you're a cybersecurity official in the White House and you are meeting with James O'Keefe, probably violating your clearance, and you're spilling all the beans about meetings that you didn't play the clip where he goes, I'm sitting with Michelle Obama and she doesn't want to run for president. That's clear. And you're in a public restaurant, and also, by the way, not in the bedroom. Mm. All these different variables, you know, and by the way, I want to say one more thing before you move on from this. I got the Ashley Biden diary. That's the president's daughter. A tipster sent it to me, and I did not publish it. So for those who think I'm an activist, I just want to hurt Biden, there are places I won't go. And my staff was upset. Many of my staff were upset I didn't publish that, but I did not publish it for a couple of reasons. You know, it's a diary. I'm not sure that people should be reading that. And I couldn't verify that it was hers, and I couldn't verify the things that she wrote in the diary occurred. And I'm not in Ross Perot. You know, they brought his family into it, and I read about that and heard about that. And so there are lines I won't cross, and there's a lot of things said in these tapes that I don't publish. People talk about personal things. It's pig's blood. So I think it's very important to take ethics extremely seriously, and it's one of the things I researched and wrote a book about.
And we mentioned Potemkin Village a few times. Essentially, Stalin set up these false utopias in Ukraine to take journalists in there to show him how wonderful everything is while catastrophe was actually breaking out all around. And one journalist got off the train before he was sent to his destination and saw the starvation and people turning on each other and the violence. It was just a disaster. But Potemkin Village is like a false, you know, something created. It's a Disneyland. Whoop, I lost you. James, I've lost James' sound.
I've got
it. Can I say something?
Yes. There you go.
I wish you guys had watched the Putin interview because I found it fascinating, and I was kind of hoping that...
I did watch a lot of it.
Yeah, but like, I would love to know James' take on his masquerade.
I have it on a few things to do. I've been in the
field. Gotta watch it.
But I want to say Potemkin Village also could mean like Shane Smith, the founder of Vice, you know, that big media company in Brooklyn that I guess went bankrupt or is no longer relevant. You know, but Shane Smith would make it when the investors came, he made it look like he had all more employees and they were doing all these things. And as soon as the investors left, it went back to its original size. It's just any type of deception towards a passer in or a passerby or someone who's documenting. And that's why people are more honest when they don't know they're being recorded.
And I think Susan is saying that she feels like Putin was espousing Potemkin Village sort of.
Oh,
like,
sure.
Okay, all right. Well, everyone knows he's a leader. Look, much like our leaders are not telling the truth. He told
a little bit of truth at the very end. There were a couple of questions. You have to go all the way to the end.
All right.
I'm not going to give you a spoiler alert.
But. Why were you fired, James? What happened?
Yeah, another difficult thing to summarize in 30 seconds. You know, it was really bizarre. I wrote an essay about it on the year anniversary last week. It's posted there on my X page if you scroll down a minute. But one of the board members was extremely acting very bizarrely. And I probably should have fired some people. I didn't. I made a mistake. And I did not put the right people on my board. 501c3s require a board. Nonprofits require boards. I don't know if your audience knows that. And I ran it like a company, even though no one owns a nonprofit. So in nonprofits, it's challenging because no one owns anything. So achievement is often a liability and no good deed goes unpunished. It happens in hospitals, churches. And we got to a point where one of the guys, I knew it was not good. And a number of big donors told me he was extremely envious of me. So he kind of created of 75 employees, he found about 8 to 10 who wanted to create this sort of Maoist mutiny. And he was successful. He got someone to vote with him and they voted me. They suspended me as CEO and it was a crazy and wild and I would even say spiritual experience for me. I learned a lot about myself, about leadership, about people, human nature, jealousy, power. I have since learned that almost everyone goes through this in some way or another in business. I mean, you know, either at Elon Musk or Steve Jobs or the guy who founded Uber, there's a lot of people that go through this. And what I learned is that, you know, I needed to be a little more discerning when it comes to selecting board members and executives around me.
Have you read Elon's biography, the Isaacson biography?
I just finished it, actually.
Yeah. And so you saw that it's kind of, I was having a conversation with someone today about this, that he, those experiences taught him to be able to fire people even when they're close to him. Yes. He just fired ruthlessly. I mean,
yeah. I am so happy that you brought that up. That was my mistake. I was raised to believe the best in people. And frankly, I have to have empower everyone. So I'm always looking for the angels in men, even bad people. I'm trying to find, like, how can I best utilize you? And what Elon did, that's just how you have, if you want to be a CEO of a company, that's just what you have to do. It may not be pleasant, but in my company, everyone was friends with each other. Even my chief financial officer and my number two, they were actually friends with the employees. They still are. And I would say, you can't do that. You can't give someone a raise because you're friends with them. That's actually unethical. But
you have to have boundaries. You have to have boundaries. Human relationships need boundaries.
I became the only bad guy. I became, and I was also the brand. I was the face. So it was a very strange dynamic. I was the chief fundraiser, the chief executive officer. I was the on anchor, and I was the talent. And I had effectively 50 to 70 people that were supporting. And a lot of those people expressed anger that they weren't getting the credit. I said, well, you're an undercover journalist. You want a byline? So it became a very unhealthy dynamic. And one day, after the Pfizer story, we did this story in Pfizer a year ago, which was the biggest story that we had ever done. One of the board members said, we no longer need James O'Keefe involved in this operation anymore. And I'm not sure they thought that out, because after they voted me out, there was an absolute rebellion from the supporters in the audience, and they withdrew all the money. But that was the hardest thing I have ever been through. I've been incarcerated. I've been raided by the FBI. I've been sued 30 times. But obviously, it felt like I was castrated, and I had to go through a lot of pain. What Elon talks about with PayPal, I think he wrote about that. And I quickly started a new organization about a month later. And now I am proud to say that I have learned my lessons and, hopefully, God willing, don't make some of the same mistakes. And, I've found some amazing people. We have a smaller team now, I would say about a dozen full-time employees, and we're working with a lot more citizen volunteers, citizen journalists, and whistleblowers. So I think it's a healthier dynamic now.
And that tends to be what happens. It tends to get healthier with these sort of crises. And Musk just kept his eye on the ball, which was, I've got to save humanity by taking them to another planet. And if I have to fire people and it's unpleasant, that's just, there's a higher calling here. One thing I'm not going to be able to get to today, I don't think, is this. I was going to split up the kind of conversation. Maybe we have to have another conversation or a beer sometime. But we had the ensconced elite. And the other thing for me is something called oikophobia. You ever heard of that? It's the Western hate of itself. There's a theory that societies, as they evolve, sort of turn in on themselves when they become successful. And it's got a term in the West called oikophobia. I hope I'm getting the name right, but I don't have time for that. I'm gonna leave that as sort of just hanging as a thought, and ask you about Pfizer. Can you talk about that? And B, what are your thoughts on what's going on there? I think you saw the little clip we played rolling in here, that there's stuff, doesn't make sense. There's a lot of questioning. What do you have an evolved sense of where we are with Pfizer and vaccines?
I don't. This is not an area I'm a subject matter expert. You and your guests you've had on, and it's not really an area that I can only speak to what, some of the people I've covertly interviewed have said, like Jordan Walker, who's a director of mRNA, but you already know that. Some of the other whistleblowers I've worked with a few. I've broken probably about three or four stories on Pfizer, but I'm in no way a subject matter expert to speak beyond what you've already seen in the videos.
Okay. And can you clue us in? I'm looking at my notes. I have so much I want to talk to you about. It's been a great conversation. I appreciate you being here so much. Can you tip your hat at all to what's coming and what you're interested in going? Yeah, go ahead.
I just broke a story last week on a Ramada compound, Casa Alitas, which is this NGO funded by the feds in Tucson. That went viral. You can look on our X account and see these videos. Every Wednesday now, we do a report, which is a deadline. I've created an internal deadline. So every Wednesday at 4 o'clock, we break a story. And we're about to break one. We almost got killed on the border. There are these secret camps, like almost like NGOs. They're nonprofit groups, but they get money from the government. It is wild what's happening on the border. And I know it's a cliche, border, 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 but I mean, it's just crazy. I mean, we're talking big money, billions of dollars. There's me as a homeless guy on the perimeter of this one complex. That was last week. And while I was snoping around, we put cameras on illegal immigrants that went inside the place and recorded wild conversations. So I feel like the border is the number one issue of this election. I think all of it, the money, the amount of money that it's an industry traffic is one word, ship, but 1 in 10 of these kids get raped and trafficked in this child and people trafficking organization. So a lot of my sources are on the inside now long term. But this coming Wednesday, you're going to see me personally, James O'Keefe, go to one of these camps in the middle of nowhere, okay, in Arizona. I'm talking 30 miles away from the nearest road. And the things that you will hear and see, we almost got killed. And what's crazy is that these people are getting money from the government. So I think this is going to be a big issue. It's ongoing. It's going to be my major focus this year.
James, thank you so much. Follow James on Twitter. Follow the new company on Twitter. Go to the website, which is, hold on here. You can tell me. O'Keefe Media. Is that it? O'Keefe Media Group.
OKeefeMediaGroup.com. And you can follow me at my name on all platforms, Instagram, X, Telegram, James O'Keefe, Roman numeral 3. I'm James the 3rd. James O'Keefe, III, is where you can get. That's a capital I there. You can get all of our videos there.
Okay. So it's X, at X, James O'Keefe, K-E-E-F-E, I-I, capital I, capital I, capital I, James O'Keefe. The 3rd.
And with Instagram, you can follow me there, both places.
All right, James, been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Cheers. Yeah, that's interesting, right? Susan, I feel you wanting to say something.
Yeah.
What? What do you want to say?
I just wish you guys at home to watch the Putin thing.
We wouldn't be in a position to talk about it. That's not his thing.
Why not?
No, we'd be speculating. Is Putin reliable? No. Is his history accurate? Maybe. Is Tucker a journalist? Kind of. There we go. Now we've talked about it. That's about all you can really say. What is it you want to talk about? Maybe we should get a guest that penetrates in a way you want a Russian.
Yeah, we need to get Brian O'Shea back.
Or a Russian. How about a Russian expert? Just somebody who really, remember we used to talk to a Castro expert?
Yeah. There's a guy here on Rumble who said he lived over there and said, what does that say? Subterfugal decades where people are being issued passports in countries and wishes to conquer the Crimea. He tells half-truths to help his cause, which I felt in the conversation. And our government
is that different? Is that different than other politicians?
It's always been like that. I mean, but
is that different? I don't know.
But he was trying to rally his nationalistic
He's trying to rally us too.
He was. There's no rule. You shouldn't be afraid of us.
He's a KGB operative, guys.
You shouldn't be worried about us. We're just, they're a little Russian country.
Maybe tell the truth. I love Russians, or don't you?
No, I love Russians. Yeah, nobody who lives in Russia really likes Putin that much either.
That's not true.
When we were there, remember, people were very upset with the way that things were going. That was
there was 12 years ago. There was people that loved
I can't believe he's been there 12 years. Like if somebody stays that for that long and things aren't going well, it's just sad.
We'll call them a dictator just for the sake of argument. So Rumble, guys, I know there's a lot of you watching James today. Please do subscribe, follow. We'd love you a part of our Rumble channel. We'll give you a shout out. We'll give you a blast when we go on the air. Caleb, if you could put the upcoming guest on, you'll see that you'll want to be a Rumble guest. Jimmy Dore tomorrow, Alex Berenson the next day, Zuby coming in. Rob Henderson is a great guest. Great new book coming out called, I can't remember. You're going to put it up there, I'm sure. Brett Weinstein, March 5th. I'm very excited about that.
Oh my gosh.
Very excited.
That's exciting. That. And, maybe he knows about Russia.
He's a biologist. So don't get too, if we get too geeky, you're going to have to straighten me out during the
interview. No, that's okay. We'll find somebody.
And he's an evolutionary biologist. Actually, I think that's his actual formal training. But in any event, which is just saying a biologist. Everybody, you got to know the biology, the foundation of biology is evolutionary processes and science and chemistries, biochemistry. So in any event, what was I going to say? I lost it. Rob Henderson, you can put the book up there, Caleb. If you've had, it's called Disturbed or something like that. I've read it. It's great. It was lying around here. Don't see it right now. I think it's out now. It's a personal story. Rob Henderson is a young man that was disturbed or troubled. It's called Troubled. It's called Troubled. That's what it is called. And he goes sideways and he ends up in the military and that kind of saves him. And then he's able to use the military bill to go to Yale. And he goes to Yale and is shocked at the way these privileged students behave and the way they think. Then he goes to Cambridge or Oxford, where he becomes a social psychologist. And he, I think, still there and teaching. And a great guy, a great story. And it's everything we talk about. So, all right. So, okay, don't worry. Caleb tells me he can't throw the book up. That's fine. It's all good. It's called Troubled. I recommend it most highly.
Caleb doesn't have a mic today, so.
I know. And follow us on X.
Caleb, his roadcaster went on the, it's a communist plot. I don't know.
Well, maybe it is. Or maybe it's people that hate James O'Keefe. I noticed a lot of bots afoot on Rumble Rants today. I don't know if you saw that.
It was all right. Susan. Everybody was cool.
Well, there was some interesting commentary going on.
I'm sure.
Yeah. So there we are, buddy. We appreciate you being here. Appreciate being a part of this. Dr.
Love you over on YouTube.
Dr.com. Subscribe at Rumble. I've been watching your comments, as I said, on the restream. Oh, that's right. I'm going to be on Jimmy Dore's show today, this afternoon. I don't know when it's airing, however. I don't know how he does that, but I'll be.
Is he live?
Anybody? Bueller? Somebody help me? Anybody? Somebody on restream?
Well, there's a delay, so nobody's going to be able to answer right away.
Thank you, James.
Give it a couple minutes.
Tom Cigars. Thank you, sir. Somebody said, was it Super Bowl? We heard somebody's keeping jeans high and tight. They want Susan more. I'm just reading the restreams here. The doubt is that it's live. I doubt it's live.
You know what? Here's the thing. I study Russian history and Chinese history and Arab history in college. Mm-hmm. And it was right before, the invasion of Kuwait and Saddam Hussein and all this other stuff. You know, and in the 80s, it was just, everything was just hearts and flowers everywhere. And then all of a sudden, I was learning about wars, in the late 80s. Mm-hmm. And I found Russian history really, and Chinese history to be my thing, and communism and everything. But I also know that, the propaganda is propaganda. If you watched the video, you have to kind of read into it and see what, look at his gestures, look when he kind of laughs before he says something, because you can tell, like, by body language that he's uncomfortable with the question, and most of it was at the end. But, to know the history of Russia is really important, and of China as well.
But
he did do a long diatribe, and I have to say the guy has brain cells left, because he told a very good story. But Tucker was very nice until the end of the thing, so stick till the end. And just
one thing, by the way, so I'm of Ukrainian descent, and I didn't know any of that, which was kind of fascinating. But I did know that there was this deep sense of being Russian, because we were always told we were Russian. But the interesting thing that was left out, what Scott Adams calls the dog that's not barking, he didn't talk about. He jumped from all that Ukrainian. He jumped from about 1640 to Catherine the Great. And what he didn't talk about was the extreme violence of Peter the Great and some of the other czars that came through there, and how they consolidated power in those areas, and how they forced all the aristocrats to move to St. Petersburg, and they built this thing out of nothing because he was jealous of Versailles. Anyway, longer story, the sort of the more quasi-modern history of Russia, he just leapt over about 200 years, which I thought was fascinating. And then he was really
aiming, leaves out the bad stuff.
He was aiming at the Crimea. He was aiming at justifying the reason for the Crimea. He said, Catherine the Great restored it. You notice he put it that way.
They just wanted the port. They wanted the port so badly.
They wanted the port, and they will not give it up. There's no way they'll give Sebastopol.
That was their power. But it just, I mean, it's just interesting, like reading body language and hearing how he just so speaks so glowingly of the mother country, but how he was trying to get things done.
And
but
the Russians are that way.
People didn't want to show up, or they didn't take my offer, and so we just walked away. But it was all in good faith, and you know, which is bullshit.
Poor me.
But it was interesting though that they got Tucker in there and that he went through it. It was a good interview. So
okay.
I don't know why people don't want to watch it. It's weird.
We will leave it there. And tomorrow we are going early, not going early. There was talk about going at 2:30 tomorrow. Is that what we're doing?
Yeah, we're going to start at 2:30.
We are going to bring Jimmy Dore live. So you may not see him and me live
today.
If
you can't get enough Jimmy Dore, come see us.
Our warm-up is on his show, and then we're going to get into it.
Somebody on Rumble said, but Susan, our history is light. I think, you know what?
Is light?
Is a lie. There's all kinds of, you know, interpretations of history, obviously, you know, and you can't really be a historian unless you weren't alive when it happened. And you have to research it based on what was written, I guess. So
by the people that lived it, which is a new way of doing it.
But now I'm really realizing that nothing written is real anymore. So how the fuck are we supposed to look at this historically?
The letters, so whatever. We're not going to solve that problem.
Nobody's going to be honest about, you know, how many people died from the vaccine. You know what I mean? So
we'll see. History has a way.
It'll be 100 years before we figure it out.
Reality, right. Reality is a way of asserting itself, so stand by. We'll see you tomorrow at 2:30 Pacific. Ask Dr. Drew is produced by Caleb Nation and Susan Pinsky. As a reminder, the discussions here are not a substitute for medical care, diagnosis, or treatment. This show is intended for educational and informational purposes only. I am a licensed physician, but I am not a replacement for your personal doctor, and I am not practicing medicine here. Always remember that our understanding of medicine and science is constantly evolving. Though my opinion is based on the information that is available to me today, some of the contents of this show could be outdated in the future. Be sure to check with trusted resources in case any of the information has been updated since this was published. If you or someone you know is in immediate danger, don't call me, call 911. If you're feeling hopeless or suicidal, call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 800-273-8255. You can find more of my recommended organizations and helpful resources at drdrew.com/help.